Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. And today I'm joined by Kauri Paulsson. So Kauri, thank you for joining me. Do you want to just take a second to maybe say a little bit about who you are and what we're going to talk about?
Yes, thank you for having me. My undergrad was on folklore, Icelandic folklore. And as time went on, I started to focus more and more about old Icelandic literature and old Norse religion. And I did my PhD thesis with Professor Terry Gunnell, where I was focusing on certain stones often associated with blood rituals or some sacrificial rituals. Mm-hmm. And from there, it was an easy step for me to do my master in Old Norse religion, again with Terry. And then I decided to turn my focus a little bit to Gíslasaga Súrssonar, which is the topic of today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, what was it like learning with Terry?
he's a very humorous guy. He's a funny guy, and he's very, very knowledgeable. And but what I like about him is his approach. You know, he's always telling me and other students, like, I'm giving you the tools, now you have to prove me wrong.
Yeah.
You know, he is very open to new ideas and that.
Oh, absolutely. So
he's supportive. And I mean, that's what academia should be about also. You know, you come with a new idea and then 10 other people try to attack your idea. So that's just how it works, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. We had Terry on the podcast probably years ago at this point, and he was a lot of fun. Like you say, he always has some interesting ideas, but he backs them up as well. It's not like he just creates them. He backs them up with. So,
You know, we might disagree once in a very while, but that's just, you know, how it is, you know, but it's on very minor things, maybe.
I imagine in academia, you have to disagree. And, it, you know, it doesn't have to become something major where you're like, we're never speaking ever again. I hate you. But I'm sure it's healthy to have a level of disagreement where you're challenging each other's ideas, and that has to drive things forwards.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And you know, oftentimes I've thought about, like, wait, I don't know about that. Then when I read more and I figure out, oh, well, he had some very good points on that. So I keep on learning too, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's still a lot of things I have to learn, you know, definitely. The more I dive into this, the less I feel I know, if that makes sense.
That makes complete sense. And on a completely different level, you know, when I started this podcast with Matthias back 2019, I think we started this, I was, you know, probably bordering on like a Viking bro type, because I didn't know any better. You know, I got a lot of my information from whether it was TV shows or just web searches or memes. I was very much kind of that mindset. Now, I would say I differed in a sense of that I was always eager to learn, and I would listen to people who maybe, whereas you get some people who just refuse to listen and they just think they know best regardless. But I certainly got a lot of my information from that. I thought that I knew everything. I thought I had this Norse mythology thing sewn up. I was like, yeah, you know, like Loki had these three kids and the death of Balder started Ragnarok, and, you know, Frey had a ship that you could fold up and put it in his pocket, and all these like typical things that you hear. And then when I started with Matthias, I'm like, fuck, like, I know nothing, like absolutely nothing. And I still think, like, 140 odd episodes into this, and we're going to sit here and talk, and there's going to be bits in here that I'm like, I've never even heard of that. You said earlier about dream women as part of like the pre-Christian rituals. And I'm like, what the fuck is dream women? I've never even heard of that before.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we can talk about them later. I mean, they are very complicated, and I would not maybe categorize them as some pre-Christian figures, but I think arguably they're very connected to one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very connected to that.
I'm definitely looking forward to it. I love hearing about things I've never heard of before. That's one of my favorite things. But the Kenai in the chat, and I think anybody who watches this will notice the stave behind you is recognizable. We saw that with Georgia Sottetetti.
Yeah, that's correct. She did an amazing job with her pocket idols research, and it was very, very good. I was very proud of her.
Yeah, it was a
good support.
It was a very good episode. It was a really fun episode. So you said, yeah. Did you paint the stave?
I did, yeah. Some years back. It is a Icelandic staff called gestastavur, meaning a guest staff. It's a welcoming symbol, but also a protection. Mm-hmm. Basically what I did, I just opened the book and I found something cool and I painted it, you know. Just,
it looks cool.
I didn't have any crazy intention. Yeah, it's...
Yeah, it looks...
It's homemade.
It's a good backdrop for a podcast.
Mm.
Perfect. So should we get into Gisla Saga? I think...
Yes.
I think, first of all, is there a source where people can go and read it if they want to? Maybe they want to pause the episode now and read it ahead of time. Is there somewhere where you would recommend people can do that?
Well, there are some translations online. There is one famous translation made by Peter Foot, although I think it's maybe a little bit outdated. But I think there's also one by Penguin Books, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
But they are this is one of the most famous sagas of Icelanders, so it's definitely available. In stores and
just you can pop it, and I wasn't sure whether maybe there was a website that kind of just that you trusted that would have it as a good source.
Well, I think, you know, I personally haven't really read the translations, but I through my quick search I saw a bunch of them.
Okay.
And but this translation by Peter Foot is rather popular, and he also has a little bit of an introduction of in English with an English summary and so on. So it's a good start.
Perfect. Yeah. So people can go and check it out there. But we're going to give you're going to give a little summary of the saga anyway, so we can get a little bit of an understanding of kind of what happens before we discuss it in any depth.
Yeah. Basically, it is. The Icelandic family sagas have arguably the most famous outlaw sagas. This saga is categorized as a saga of an outlaw person who is has to live in an outlawry for some years. And the most famous one is Grettis saga. But this is, I'm not going to say a lesser known, but another outlawry saga that... takes place in the late 10th century. The beginning of the saga takes place in Norway, and they settle in, and after leaving Norway, they settle in Dýrafjörður in the Westfjords. And it tells the story of the protagonist, Gísli Súrsson, who must kill one of his brother-in-law to avenge another brother-in-law. And
which Gisli, seems very typical of an Icelandic saga.
Well, do you know the roots of it? Because of women.
Okay.
Because of women and jealousy. And so, you know, the typical recipe for disaster in Icelandic family saga is people arguing for women and love and so on.
That doesn't change. I feel like that's a thing that still happens today.
But the Gisli is forced to stay on the run for 13 years before he is hunted down by Börkudýri and his men and killed. And and he lives as an outlaw for 13 years, and he changes location. But the main stage of the saga is in the Westfjords of Iceland, which is if you know the map of Iceland, you see the little fjords in the west. Mm-hmm. That's the main states of the saga, especially around Dýrafjörður, which is a beautiful place, by the way.
I mean, all of Iceland is pretty beautiful.
Yeah, but I think Westfjords are among my favorite. It's very, very different Iceland than you might see in tourist books or whatever.
Okay.
It's very scenery. I think it looks a bit like some western parts of Norway. Maybe okay. Not as majestic, but they're still very fjordy.
Okay,
a lot of fjords.
Yeah.
And basically what happens that these are basically four guys. It's Gísli Súrsson, Þorkell Súrsson, his brother, and then Þorgrímur Goði and Vésteinsson. They are basically four guys that live close to each other, except Vésteinn. And they are trying to prevent things to go out of hand. So what they do a kind of blood brotherhood to make things not go bad. But
okay.
The ritual got kind of interrupted and everything broke loose from there. And this Vésteinn gets killed very likely by Þorgrímur Goði, one of the four guys. The okay. saga is kind of not telling who that was. And
like a little
then,
bit of mystery.
A little bit, but the saga is strongly hinting it was Þorgrímur Goði who was one of those four guys that took place in this blood brotherhood ritual. And then Gísli wants to avenge his foster brother, Vésteinn, and he kills Þorgrímur Goði. And from there, Gísli is basically outlawed and he lives as an outlaw for 13 years with all those events that happens mm-hmm. after that, which is maybe too long to talk about maybe now, but
yeah,
basically what we're dealing with is an outlaw that is trying to seek shelter here and there and he's trying to keep him afloat and keep him alive by hiding in various places.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, during that time, he encounters these women. They come to him. One of the women is good to him. The other one is less good to him, as he says in the saga. And then the saga is also filled with a seyður ritual. There is a man called Þorgrímur Nef who carries out seyður magic to make the murderer of Þorgrímur Goði not be restless in Iceland, so which is Gísli Súrsson, so he's having troubles because of the seyður ritual. But what's interesting about Gísla saga is that a lot of the saga takes place in Gísli's mind, which is rather unusual for Icelandic saga.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's very scenery, like this man said this man said that, but there's a lot of in a lot of places this saga is describing something that happened in his mind, like especially through the poetry. He's reciting poetry about those dream women and so on. But yeah, we can talk about them later, of course.
Yeah. Could that be
a lot of stuff out.
So when you say it's in his mind, is it more like an internal monologue of him explaining what he's seen, or maybe like a sense of some sort of mental illness, kind of him having a little bit of a breakdown?
It's not very, I wouldn't necessarily call it a monologue. Well, maybe if he's reciting this poetry to Auður, his wife. But, you know, sometimes describing his or hinting at this fear or longings, you know. But a lot of it takes place in the skaldic poetry, definitely. So, yeah, I think that arguably, when I say it takes place a lot in his mind, I mean that like when you dream and you recite the poetry after the dream, you're talking about something that occurred when you were alone. Mm-hmm. Also, more than half of the Skaldic poetry in Gísla saga is about those women.
Okay.
This is rather interesting.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
towards the end, kind of what happens? How do we progress from him being isolated and on his own to then kind of how do we conclude?
The last years he's hiding both in a fjord called Geirþjófsfjörður and in an island called Hergilsey. During his last year, he is hiding mostly in the fjord of Geirþjófsfjörður. By the way, I've been to that fjord and there's no road into that fjord, and it's super foresty and it's rather a magical place. But he dies in Geirþjófsfjörður. The saga states that he was hunted by Börkur Digri and his men, and he had this heroic death by jumping off a cliff and chopping one guy at the same time as dying himself. You know, that's a little bit of, we can question, of course, how reliable that is, mm-hmm. but the saga states that he dies in Geirþjófsfjörður. And so he dies as a hero, we can say.
From okay. There. Yeah. So he doesn't get any sort of redemption and get to live out a happy life?
No.
I mean, it seems to very rarely happen in Icelandic sagas.
Yeah, I mean, you can be a very cool guy and you die miserably, and you can be a bastard that that gets all the success, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there doesn't seem to be... It's not a case of the good guy winning.
No, not really. I mean, the only good guy winning, if you can say so, is that foster mother, Guðríður, she walks to Rome and takes Christianity. And that's, of course, how you need to end a saga. You need to end it in a very Christian way, you know.
Okay.
So that's a good thing. She found the light, you know.
Fair enough.
This saga takes place in the 10th century, but of course it's written much later.
Okay.
I mean, how, of course, with Icelandic sagas in general, you know, how reliable they are, it's very open to question. Mm-hmm. But they are often, not all of them, but some of them arguably are relying on some oral family memory. And what's rather interesting about Gísla saga, to my mind, is that it's often referring to orality in general. So the saga often states, það var sagt, it is said, or that men segja, people say, or the saga says that knowledgeable men claim that, vitrir menn segja það. Like, it's often referring to some tales around, but that's also an interesting thing when we research the background of the saga. We can find characters in Gísla saga also in other Icelandic sagas, such as Eyrbyggja saga or Egil saga, for example, and in Laxdala saga. We can see characters, you know, and they are basically introduced without an explanation. Like, oh yeah, of course, that guy, you know. And
so would you assume that maybe that they're characters that are meant to be known widely at the time? Like everybody would.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that, yes, that in many cases they are meant to be known. Sometimes the saga is hinting at us that we should know a little bit about a certain person or something. But we can also find reference to Gísli Súrsson, in, for example, the contemporary saga, Sturlunga saga corpus, which is written, most of it was written by Sturla Thorlarsson, and it's referring to, they're talking about some event, and then a spear was used, and they say, and the saga states very casually, this spear was owned by Gisli Súrsson. The spear is named Grásíða, which is the spear, named Grásíða in Gísla saga. So, and the Sturlunga saga throws this into the text and expects the reader to know exactly everything about Gísli Súrsson and his spear Grásíða.
Okay.
So we're having some cultural memory of, this is something that memory scholars called Ljungsten de Memoir. So you're connecting an object with a character or events.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also something you see regularly in the Icelandic family saga corpus. When you see a place name, you view it differently because you know a certain story happened around it. A good example, if you would see Þingvellir in Iceland, you know, where the parliament took place.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you would go there without knowing any of the story, any of the saga, you would view it differently. But because you know all the history that we get told around it, I think we see that place in a little bit different light, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we spoke about that before on here in a bunch of different circumstances. One that always strikes me is, you know, you can go somewhere where maybe a terrible event has happened and you get like a feeling of something bad. But is that part of, because you know what's happened, so you put that feeling in there, or does this place itself hold some sort of feeling or power to make you feel a certain way?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's something that, I mean, we can see this especially with Geirþjófsfjörður, that if I remember correctly, there was one instance when another literature is mentioning Hergilsey, where he hides in the island of Hergilsey. That's casually thrown in another saga. Yeah, that the island of Hergilsey where Gísli hid for some years. And, you know, people are again meant to remember that. And that was not really a tragedy. That was just common knowledge, if we can say so, for people at the time. But if we talk about the saga in this context, Most of the manuscripts of Gísla saga, there are in total 33 manuscripts of Gísla saga, but there are basically the oldest one is from around the 1400. But scholars, linguists are arguing that the text could be dated from before 1250, so maybe 1220, 30, 40. Maybe 50.
Okay.
And then we have another version that is considered the younger version, which is has a slight different variation. But that version is though oftentimes it is as Emily Lethbridge argued. She did a great throughout study of the textual variation of Gísla saga. She argued that The younger version is no less of a saga than the older version. You know, when you think about it, what is a saga? You know, it has a lot of plots and plots develop, and you know the sagas undergo a constant upgrade like a website. You know, but still it can retain some memory maybe, but. These main manuscripts, these oldest value manuscripts of Gísla saga, they can all be traced to the Vestfjords or to the western part of Iceland, which might hint at that the saga was seen as popular saga in the Vestfjord area.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it might be something very, very localized. But why the saga was written, that's open to question. It can't be that somebody had some, it was written for some purpose, you know, for, now I'm brain farting in English right now. sorry. So like, because of some settlement or legal purposes or power purposes or something like that.
Like a precedent.
We could argue it's because of some possession or claims of land or whatever. Okay. Maybe like Landnámabók was written, the Butler's Book of Settlement. You know, you have a lot of stories about settlers coming to Iceland, and you often have names of the guys, and then they have stories around how they gave place names. Because they settled the land, they tamed cow around the area. So now he is a legal owner of the area, and then maybe the descendant want to remember that. I mean, what we had to keep in mind is that people remember what they want to remember, and they forget what they want to forget.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that was going to be my question earlier on. Actually, was what's the purpose of the saga? Because usually, whether it's like a moral message or something else, like why do we know why we have this saga? Why we remember it? Why it's because surely it has to be important enough for it to be written down, or even like passed on through oral tradition to the point then where it's written down. Is there some kind of overall morality issue that's tackled, or like some sort of message that's sent forward?
I think that maybe some of the events took place in some form. We don't know, of course, but in the Western there was a person that was an outlaw that killed people and was trying to survive and so on. But the version that we have today is, of course, a developed one. And, you know, since the 10th century, Iceland went through a change of religion and was also in the midst like the Sturlunga Age was taking place. There was a lot of political turbulence going on. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of change going on, and regarding the message, it could be argued that there are some Christian messages in the saga. Yes, for example, Gisli is said to go to Vébjörg in Denmark, and then he said that he stopped doing all kinds of sacrifices after he got in contact with some Christian people, but he kept on having feasts, as you know, blood feasts and sacrificial feasts as he did. And then with the dream women, we can see that the one of them is telling him to stop doing magic and stop doing maybe pagan activities. And then in the end we see this woman Guðríður going to Rome. So there is some Christian undertone in it. Yes, definitely.
Yeah, it seems like it's definitely been Christianized maybe through the ages, or before it was written down.
Also we have to keep in mind this was written by Latin learned men who got taught how to write this kind of stuff.
Do you think that they're the ones who add these little elements of, you know, Christianity is good in there whilst writing it down? Or do you think it arrives to them with these bits have already been added in kind of through the transitional period of going into Christianization?
I think we're dealing with a little bit of both. For example, with the dream women, we have a lot of poetry about them, and there they are not very there, which is something that comes from oral tradition, most likely. And we have this scholar, Johan Klaus Myhrvold, who is a Danish Norwegian linguist, who has argued that the poetry can be dated back to the 10th century, some of them. And some of the poems, we can see the pagan, the dream women being displayed a little bit more in pagan light than in the prose text. The prose text maybe displays them a little bit more Christian than the poetry. There are exceptions, but I think a little bit both. And plus, you know, when you write a saga, you also want to write it for, you're writing it for a certain audience, for them to understand from your, you know, you have to write it for their contemporary worldview and their contemporary understanding. Their contemporary understanding is different than from 10th century contemporary, 10th century understanding. So I think we're dealing with a little bit of both.
I think that's
so.
That's something to remember. I've said it, oh, I don't know, a lot of times on this podcast, that whilst we're talking like a, it rolls off the tongue, 10th century, 14th century, it's just a sentence. It sounds like it's nothing, but in reality, it's, you know, it's 400 years. A lot changes in that time. You know, it may be a different world. So we have to remember how, you know, how things change in that over the course of time, and remember that it is a big span of time.
Yeah. And but it's funny, if we look at the history of the, how people started to research Gísla saga in the late 18th century and in the 19th century, people were quite positive that this is all truth story, and you know, we can trust this material. Mm-hmm. And especially in the 19th century, we had Icelandic archaeologists going to the area of Gísla saga, who basically walked with saga book in one hand and shovel in the other, trying to prove the saga was correct. And they're finding this and finding that, and oh, this is his house and this is the parliament place. And you know,
did they find anything?
One of them, Sigurður Vigfússon, he claimed to have found the temple of Þorgrimur Goði, but later excavations revealed that this was 17th century sheep house. So, you get my idea.
Sounds like it doesn't.
That's what we're dealing with. I mean, Norwegians did this too a little bit, you know, with the Gokstad and the Oseberg ship. Then, you know, they really looked into Snorri and Heimskringla, trying to get answers. Who owned the ship? Why is it here? And who's the owner? You know, and linking this, it's a little bit of cherry picking, but there's a lot of political romanticism and involved, a nationalism involved, especially during that time. I mean, scholars today, they're a little bit more humble about this.
I find it fascinating, though, how, you know, we look back at them, and obviously they didn't find anything, and it's, you know, it's a little bit silly them walking around with a shovel and the saga in one hand. But do you think in 200 years people will look back at what scholars are doing today and being like, as if you were, that's so silly, why were you doing that?
Maybe. I mean, academia always develops, and who knows? Maybe it's for them to answer, not me.
Yeah. I mean, they say things. I'm sure in 200 years we will have. Well, I mean, if we're still here, if we haven't wrecked the place, the technology we would have would be unreal compared to what you have now. So, you know, I feel like we could piece together a much better story.
Yeah, precisely. And you know, but looking at how the research history of Gislason has developed. You know, it has developed into literally everything in a saga, and then there comes a little bit of time and people start to question the sagas, of course, which is a very normal thing to do. Mm-hmm. There was a different scholarship taking place, especially in the 20th century. One of them was the Frey prosa, which was especially by, it was very undertaken by Norwegians, especially Knut Liestul, who was writing that most of the Icelandic sagas and the Norwegian king saga, especially the Norwegian king saga, was basically composed in Norway, and you know they were kept in Iceland for some bit, but it's very, very Norwegian in Norwegian. And then on the other hand, we had the Icelandic school by Sigurður Nordal and those guys who were focused on that the sagas are written by an author who compiled material from here and there and just compiled it as authors. And since then, you know, of course, a middle way has to be reached. So today, there is a general agreement is that there's a little bit of both. There's a little bit of orality and a bit of input by the writer. I mean, of course, the writer has a great, he is the one who decides what gets written. So today, the general agreement is that Gislasaga has a lot of orality, but at the same time, it's draw ideas from the Nibelungenlied, Völsungasaga, and Brynhildur, and Sigurður Fáfnisbani. There has some elements of that in it. So we're getting also some ideas mm-hmm. from other literature in it too.
I was gonna say, I always wonder the origin of these stories, and I wish I could go back and see what happens, because I just wonder if it's somebody who's heard these other stories and then their own life events happen, so they kind of just make a new story up, kind of mixing in old with their real life events, and they kind of come up with this new thing that then gets passed down through generation and ends up as this very important thing to us today, because obviously we can learn things from it, but maybe it just wasn't that important at the time and it's just caught fire.
Yeah, but you know, I personally don't think that Gislasaga existed in the 10th century. I think it's based on some memories here and there, and then you know societies, the society around the Westeros, they tell stories, tell tales, and mm-hmm. that's how sagas get developed.
Yeah,
I think arguably can be something like that. And also, I think that Gislasaga does not make sense without any of the paranormal activities, such as the Dream Women or the Savior or the Blood Brotherhood. You know, if these aspects of the saga were not included, and if it was just like this real world, you know, religion or folklore or belief involved, the saga would not make much sense, I think. You know, like with Eyrbyggja saga, Eyrbyggja saga would make a lot less sense if they didn't have all these paranormal activities, you know.
Do you think maybe that's its ultimate purpose then, is to include these paranormal aspects, to whether they find that entertaining in the time that this was written down, or to keep it alive and kind of keep the knowledge going, or
I don't think it was meant to be kept alive. I think maybe people used some cultural memory of those folkloristic belief alive. This was their worldview back then. You know, some kind of magic was part of their real life, and dream were significant to these people back then. Mm-hmm. And we can see the importance of dreams just in Icelandic Saga corpus. They occur 530 times at least, dreams as some kind of prophecy or something like that. So it's seen as very important factor of, you know, and I think this was, yeah, part of their worldview, part of their reality. And so I don't think that they were trying to keep something alive, mm-hmm. but trying to write from their contemporary understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the part of the reason why I started to dive into it. If you like, one of the arguments I wanted to add earlier is that, you know, when I started to learn about, started to dive into old Icelandic literature and Old Norse religion, first I was very, very interested in mythology and mythological scenes and all the mythological poems. And we place a lot of trust or value into the poetry. You know, of course, it's a rusty key into some mythological past. But what I think often gets forgotten is the religion, Old Norse religion. And I think we can maybe try to be open to use some of the saga material to study some ritual form on another, which is one of the case study I did with my MA thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the religion is something that was very, very alive, as just as mythology, but the religion, the customary daily habits. Why did we do this, or the social understanding of, for example, doing a blood brotherhood ritual or doing some kind of burials. Why do we do this when we bury people, and why do we do this? You know,
mm-hmm.
I think that's basically what I think it's very important to underline too.
Okay, perfect. Let's talk about the specific parts of the saga, and we have to start with the dream women. We've touched on them and teased it out. So let's start there, because dreams are something I've never thought about in relation to the past, I think, in general, of just history. I don't think I've ever sat and thought, I wonder what people 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 years ago thought about dreams. And then as we've been having this conversation, it's been ticking away in my head. I've been like, yeah, of course they would see it as being maybe magical or some prophecy or some sort, maybe even witchcraft, something that's supernatural, because it is a very odd phenomenon. You know, we still have that today. We have dreams that bemuse us. You know, I wake up from a dream sometimes, and I in the dream, I think it's real. I'm like, this is real. And we've all had those dreams as well, where we wake up and we're like, thank God that wasn't real. Because when you're in the dream, something bad happens and you're like, oh my God, this is my life now. This is happened. It's real. And then you wake up and you're like, my God, thank you. I'm so happy that's not actually the reality. So I imagine that, you know, back 1,000 years ago, when magic was much more prevalent and much more believed in, that must be a big part of what explaining what these dreams are.
Yeah, definitely. Dreams definitely play a very important role. As in the case for Gísli Súrsson, he won during one Veturnætur period. Veturnætur is a certain period in the fall where summer ends and winter starts.
Okay.
And I have to explain that maybe a little bit before I dive into the dream women. In the, you know how summer are counted in weeks in the old Icelandic calendar. It starts on Thursday and it ends on Wednesday in October. And between then Thursday and Friday comes, and then Saturday comes, which is the first day of winter. And during those 2 days, it's not summer nor winter. It's a kind of a liminal time. There is not summer nor winter.
So and, would that not be like autumn? Or do they not have an autumn?
This is a little bit like the Halloween, you know. It's a very liminal time and people were hiding. If you can trust here and the Thóttr Þórhalls, it's a little short tale which talks about Vetranet. People were afraid of going out because there were creatures out there. And this time is often ruled by horse riding women coming in from the wild, especially the deities called Dísir, if you have spoken about them in your podcast. But in the case of Gísli Súrsson, he always have these dreams during this Vetranetir period, which is a very this beginning of winter time. And then he either dreams that, you know, they're called in betri or in verri. In betri means the better, in verri the worse. So some scholars like to label them as good versus evil, and I don't think that's a very good translation, because it basically means better and the other one is just not as good as the other one.
Okay.
But yeah,
good versus evil seems like a very Christian kind of, you know, you've got God and Satan and this kind of battle between the two.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just following what the sire basically is saying. And the good one is she's kind of nice to him, and she leads him into a house and show him some fires. And she says, like, these fires, the number of the fires you see there are how many winters you have left yet to live, or how many years you have left yet to live. And then the other dream woman, she comes to him and she's kind of bugging him a lot, putting a red hat on him with blood. So he's terrified of her. She's pouring blood over him, and she plays a hat over him, so the blood is flowing down his face. And
wait. A rat hat with
blood. No, a rat.
Rat. As in a rodent.
A rat.
Oh, red.
R-E-D.
Okay. I think said a rat hat. And I was like, the fuck kind of hat is this?
I don't even know
this?
What that is.
I don't know what it is. That's what I was about to ask. Okay, so a red hat.
Yeah. And she pours blood over him that leaks down his face, and she's terrifying him. And these women are coming to him basically every winter now and then. And until when Gísli dies, one of the women comes to him during the last summer day, last day of summer. Then she comes to him and says, like, oh, yeah, now you're going to die. I'm sorry. The battery one said is going to fail and you're just going to die. I'm sorry. And he dies during the last day of summer, which might explain the Gísli stubbornness to live. The first day winter back then was kind of the New Year's Eve. That's a new year because people were counted in years. Mm-hmm. And so if you understand my point, they are appearing during the first day of winter, during Vetranætur. Then they are appearing at the people's New Year's Eve back then. So okay. This is your fate for the next year. And then during the last day of summer, he dies.
Mm-hmm. Could that be
so? It might be a symbol for Yeah, so symbolic for his stubbornness to live as an outlaw.
Yeah, but I was also going to say, could that be symbolic of summer itself? Is kind of like things dying out, and you know we're getting into the winter, which is very kind of bleak.
Yeah, arguably yes, but if we look at the background, what kind of figures are these women? Like, you know, because these dream women, they're not very frequent in old Icelandic literature, and I started to check what are their features, where do they appear in other works, and I see that the Gísla saga is the oldest literature work where dream women appear. Okay. So that's that. But then they appear in later works where they have slightly different purposes, but they often are dealing with fate and prophecy. Mm-hmm. And then these Strömkonur, they are, you know, riding horseback. They are inviting to a great hall. And that's something we can see that is often associated with maybe Dísir. For example, in Bjarnasaga Hítalakappa, he dreams that a Dís comes to him and tell him the prophecy. But I would be very careful to argue that the Drömkonur are maybe not Dísir, this female deities called Dísir. Dísir are also very slightly linked to Valkyrir, if you get the connection, you know, women on horseback dealing with fate and so on. But I think that they're definitely linked to prophecy, linked to plot, linked to and they're also closely linked to the Veturnætur period, where Dísir are often coming in from the wild. Recommend for that. If somebody wants to learn more about Dísir, I recommend the article by Terry Gunnar, Dísir and Dísir and the early midwinter festival. It's on academia.edu. The seasons of the Dísir. The seasons of the Dísir. It's a very interesting one, which might explain this a little bit better. But the other Drömkonur in the old Icelandic literature, they are written later, but they have similar features. They are linked to fate and plot and prophecy. Mm-hmm. So these women coming into the dream, telling some fate, is something that arguably the society of the time Gísla saga was written would understand.
Yeah.
Did
you say they're not always evil though? They're sometimes good, sometimes bad.
Yeah. Some scholars have tried to say that one of them is definitely Christian and the other one is definitely pagan. And I don't think that's maybe a good argument, because the good one sees inviting him to a hall that kind of resembles, you know, in the description, it kind of resembles Valhöll rather than heaven.
Yeah.
She's riding horseback, which is very, very Dísir alike. But those women, they definitely have Christian features. I think that labeling them Drömkonur is just the best thing to do. The version we have of them today is a 13th century understanding of these figures that might be based on earlier roots related to Dísir.
Is it possible that they are just this year, but when they come in dream form, they maybe take a different name. Like, could they be the same thing, but when once in a dream, they just like a, like I say, just get a different name. They're just labeled differently.
Well, maybe. What is interesting is that the poetry about these drömkonur, they're never labeled as drömkonur. The poetry use some skaldic kenning something. Once they're called these, and once one of them is called Geimigöndul, which is a kenning for a valkyria. So the poetry, which is arguably older, never labels them as drömkonur. That's something just the 13th century writer decided to do.
Okay.
So I think what we're dealing with is that we're dealing with some kind of continuation. These female figures share similar features. They are bringing prophecy, delivering fate, as well as having association with blood and terror. And yeah, I think this is a sign of development over time. And I think that the term drömkonur is a 13th century invention who is building on earlier pre-Christian cultural memories of female deities that deliver prophecies around this veterinary period. So I think, yeah, this is kind of continuation, I would argue. You know, because folklore changes and it adapts to new social norms, you know, like some people argue that Iceland became Christian in the year 1000, but, you know, it takes time. It goes in steps. It never goes like, bum, now everything is Christian. It goes in steps. And I think the drömkonur is a late step of female deities that are based on earlier folkloristic memories. But I think that what gave them the future alive is that the prose writer is portraying them oftentimes in quite Christian light.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, why they got a bit of a future life.
Yeah.
So that's in short what my argument about the drömkonur was. I will try to publish this as an article soon.
Oh, wonderful. Let us know. We'll let people know where it is.
Because telling this in a podcast, there's a lot of minor things here and there that could be added. But I would then take maybe 4 hours to read it or tell it. You know?
Yeah, I'm sure. It makes perfect sense that dreams would be attached to some sort of deity to explain, particularly like a prophecy type deity, because, you know, even things like deja vu, you know, we've all had deja vu where it kind of, it happens and we think, oh, that's happened before. And I can't imagine that's a new thing.
Yeah. But also interestingly, you know, they're also delivering death when you think about it. You know, by delivering prophecy, like, this is what you have yet to live. You know, it's also a little bit delivering death, and plus the red hat and the terror around that. It's not a very nice thing, but, you know, this is crazy interesting to me, and I never get enough of this material.
Do you think that they deliver them death, or do you think they're just the messenger that says you're going to die?
The saga portrays that they deliver the message that they're going to die. But when you think about it, it's not them that kills them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the same reason, when a Valkyra chooses slaying, is it her killing the person?
I mean, it depends, doesn't it? It depends on, I mean, it's a very deep question, because how much control do they have over the natural world, I guess, in a sense? It's not them physically, let's say, swinging the sword.
No.
Or do they have the power
exactly
to make the person swing the sword, or put the person in the position that then puts them where they're getting hit by the sword?
Yeah. It's a tricky question, but I'm sure you get what I mean. You know, by delivering death, delivering the news of that you're going to die, who makes the person die? Why does he know that, you know?
And does knowing but make it a self-fulfilling prophecy? You know, if you know you're going to die, do you sometimes put yourself in a position where you might die?
I mean, like with the Valkyrie and the Deesir, as Luke John Murphy, he has written a lot about the Deesir especially, and I really enjoyed his master thesis on Herjans Deesir, and on Deesir in general, basically where he describes them as basically their death spirits. They're terrifying. Along with Valkyrie, they're terrifying beings. And as with the Draumkonur, they don't have any names. You know, like the Dream Women, like Gísli Súrsson, they don't have any names. These are anonymous female figures.
Mm-hmm.
As is the same with Deesir. They're anonymous female figures that are terrifying. It's very interesting to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It is fascinating. Yeah. I'd love... If you could get the answer, like 100%, do you think you'd want it, or do you enjoy the not knowing?
I thought about it before, because if we would know everything, this would be rather boring. I like find out things, and I wish there are bits here and there that we could know more, you know. For example, I wish that we had some sagas of the Norwegians, or sagas of the Swedes, or sagas of the Danes to compare a bit more.
Yeah.
You know, even though we have some literature from there, but it's a bit different. I wish we had maybe another Arabic writer, maybe, who saw something taking place in 9th century Norway for comparison, like if Fadlan saw in Rus, for example. I wish we had more sources for comparison.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I definitely wish that somebody would have written down in the 9th, 10th century, maybe, written down something that could give us a more understanding of some folkloristic beliefs or traditions or whatever. But if we would know everything, it would be rather boring, I think. Still interesting, but still boring.
No, I agree. And I think that's part of the popularity of this whole thing, is that there are so many gaps that you can apply your own ideas to it and apply it to your own life and get satisfaction out of it that way. It's not all, this is exactly what happened. And, you know, that's why you have so many debates over it.
Yeah, precisely. The question is, do you want me to shortly go over another case study, or you want to talk more about this?
We're just over an hour. I think we should maybe
we're over an hour.
I think we should maybe wrap this up and then you can come back and we'll do the other three. Because if anybody can tell, I am a little bit under the weather today. If I keep sniffling in the background, I do apologize. So yeah, I think let's, you know, we're over an hour. We've kind of set the scene. We've talked about the saga. People can maybe go away and read the saga, and then you can come back maybe in a couple of months and we'll look at, I think we said, the Blood Brothers, which really interests me. I would definitely want to know more about that. You said the ship burials and other burial kind of rituals are from the time. And then they say the kind of magic aspect. Because otherwise we're going to kind of be rushing through, and I'd rather we get a chance to explore them properly.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea too. We also spent a lot of time in introduction of the saga, and that is important, but next time it would be entertaining to go into the juicy parts.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I think we also had like a little bit of a lag, so I apologize if we were kind of talking on top of each other. I think there's a tiny little lag between the two of us where we're just overlapping a little bit.
Yeah, that just internet in general. It's nobody's fault.
Absolutely not. Okay, Kauri, can you let people know where they can follow you if they want to, or if you want them to?
I have this account on Instagram, Sagas of Iceland. I've been very inactive lately there, but I will get back on being active. I was very little active when I was especially finishing my thesis, but now when I graduated half a month ago, I have no other reason for not being active, so I promise I'll put in some material there. I often put in also a lot of like other nerdy things, like I collect old books, I collect old Icelandic sagas, like first prints of Icelandic sagas, and I also have some manuscripts, and I also repair old books, and sometime I'm showing also other things that might be Icelandic and cool to people, I suppose.
Wonderful. Perfect, yeah. Go give Kauri
a follow. But also my email, if people want to email me, is kap12@hi.is. Howie, H-I. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Yeah, we can pop that in the show notes so people can pop you over a question. But we're going to wrap this up and we're going to jump into a little Q&A session with the patrons so they can ask you some questions. Maybe, you know, they'll ask some questions on the other topics that we're going to come back and we can touch on them briefly in there as well. So if you do want to hear a little bit about them, you know, if you pop over onto Patreon /Nordic Mythology Podcast, you can listen to all the Q&As we do with the guests on there as well. You don't have to listen to them live or watch them live. You can get them after the fact. They all get posted on there. You also get all episodes a week earlier than everybody else as well. And you get the saga, the story type episodes as well with Jonas Lorenzen. Just pop over onto there and have a look. And if you do like the show, please take a minute to leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review. It does help us keep bumping up the charts. It really helps out. It takes you, you know, 30 seconds, but it does really help us. And yeah, follow the podcast everywhere, just at Nordic Mythology Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, the Facebook group. It's all out there. You know that by now. Yeah, Kauri, thank you very much. Let's wrap this up and answer some questions.
Thank you for having me.